Hey, everybody, before the show starts here, I just want to give a brief disclaimer. We're going to be talking about some difficult subject matter involving some sexual content. Due to the nature of the work of the author we'll be discussing. And so if you have any small children that you don't want to listen, and none of what we're going to talk about is going to be extremely graphic, but it's difficult stuff. So, and we're also going to have some spoilers for the books we'll be talking about. Just wanted to give that caveat, the disclaimer at the beginning. And then, I'll be having on a guest, who's written a few books, the books are Between Light and Shadow, An Exploration of the Fiction of Gene Wolfe, and Between Time and Memory, An Exploration of the Fiction of Gene Wolfe. And he's editing, I won't give you the guest name until we start the show, but he's editing The Wolf's Lair, Critical Essays on Gene Wolfe, published by Gregorio Montejo at Kitestic Press. So that's coming out soon, and I'm saying this now because we forgot to mention it during the show. So, without further ado, we will start the show. Thank you.
Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith.
Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. This is Aaron Erber, your host, and today we are finally going to talk about Gene Wolfe. I have been name-dropping Gene Wolfe on almost every single episode of the show, and I keep promising people that I'll have a Gene Wolfe episode at some point. The problem was with Gene Wolfe is he's very intimidating. He's written so much, and there's so much that goes into even one of his stories that it's hard to talk about. So I kind of decided I'm just going to reach out to get my guest, who is Wolfe scholar Mark Aramini. And I'm just like, Mark, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do a Wolf episode. So you can come on and you can help me out. And you graciously agreed. So Mark, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Mark Aramini. Hopefully some of you who've heard of Wolf before have at least heard my name in some connotation, whether that be good, bad, somewhere in between, because the only reason you would have heard of me is because of the writing that I've done on him. I'll give you a little bit about my background here very quickly. I was born Catholic, and my mother, you know, has always been very religious, and so I'm pretty steeped in that religious tradition there. And I've been a science fiction fan since I was, you know, a small child, you know, third and fourth grade. I remember making my parents take me to the bookstore like every day to buy a new book because I'd read the one the day before. I'm sure they got a little bit tired of it. But my educational background, my undergraduate degree is from the University of Notre Dame in biochemistry. I got a little sick of lab accidents and stuff like that. And because I organic chemistry, I'm dangerous in there.
Yeah.
So I decided, I want to do something more fun. So my master's degree is in English literature. And after from maybe 14 years out of school, I decided to go back and get my doctoral degree from UNLV, also in English literature. And I got to focus on Gene Wolfe, actually, while I was there. And I'd already written so much that my thesis pretty much wrote itself. So I've taught at several different colleges. I've been at Mojave Community College, at Walter State in Tennessee. I've taught online with Grand Canyon University and some other online classes. But I've had a whole bunch of other jobs, from working in banking, in gyms. I've also had the opportunity to find properties for a traveling show. So really, there's no one set thing. It's kind of eclectic. But, you know, always I'm coming back to, in my spare time, reading for fun, reading for pleasure, reading for kind of an escape from all those realities. And I think that Gene Wolfe provides all the mental exercises that I really need. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's where I keep coming back. And I have pretty much one essay left to finish to have written on everything that he's ever published. I cannot finish my Land Across essay. So that's been kind of frustrating. But otherwise, yeah, that's where I am.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention lab work, because I have a background in the hard sciences and biology and entomology, and I got sick of lab work, like working with chemicals and stuff, pretty quickly. So I like the field portion of it, where you go and collect insects. That's really fun. I like pinning them and processing them. But we used to make this is really off topic, but we used to make like kill jars for insects. And usually, if you're an undergrad, you'd have ethyl acetate, which is not very toxic. You know, it's not very. I mean, you don't want to like drink it or anything, but it's not. You know, it dissipates pretty quickly. You have to recharge it constantly. But in order to be a true, you know, field researcher, you need to work with potassium cyanide, which is which is you sniff that, you're dead. Like that's how dangerous that is. And so I made a bunch of potassium cyanide kill jars for insects using like plaster of Paris and stuff. And it was in a fume hood, you know, and I convinced myself that I had caught a whiff of it. And so I had a full-on panic attack, and I just put everything down, and I walked around outside for like half an hour just trying to breathe, and I'm like, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. I hate lab work. I don't like working with chemicals. I'm not cut out for it. So anyway, that's I like the field portion, like collecting the insects off the flowers, off the plants, whatever. You know, that's fine. Identifying them is fine. Sweaty, hot field work is fine with me. I would rather do that than, you know, working in a cramped lab with dangerous chemicals that if you screw up, you're dead. You know, that's not what I want to do. So,
yeah, I remember breeding fruit flies for retinal degeneration.
Oh yeah,
Drosophila melanogaster, and I remember we would have to like put them to sleep to select for the traits that we wanted to breed there.
Right.
And you know, if you do it too long, you sterilize them or kill them.
Exactly.
And I remember going to the cafeteria afterwards and seeing fruit flies just everywhere all over the fruit. And I'm like, looks like somebody's escaped from lab.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
oh, man.
I don't know. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's not. It takes a special kind of person, I think, to do that hardcore laboratory work. But anyway, so what brought you to reading Wolf? What drew you to him? What was your first exposure to reading Gene Wolf?
Yeah, sure. I've told this story in several venues, so if you've heard me talk before, then you may have heard this. I apologize for the repetition, but, you know, when I was a child, I loved those science fiction books, and, like, it seemed like I was starting at, like, the beginning and the end of the bookshelf, because, you know, you start up there with Asimov, then on the other end you have Zelazny,
right.
So I was a big fan of those, and my father actually had an employee he was working with who was a member of the science fiction book club, and when he would finish with books, he would pretty much just give me boxes of books. And he gave me a huge box one time. I was in the fourth grade, maybe. And it had books by, I remember, like, C.J. Cherry. And it did have Claw the Conciliator, that SFBC hardback version. And I looked at it, you know, it's got that funky illustration there with the man apes. And
right.
I'm like, man, this is volume two. So I got my dad to take me to a used bookstore. And I found a paperback, tattered Timescape paperback, I think, of Shadow of the Torturer there, and goodness, you know, he's on the scaffold, and I started reading that one, and instantly, right, you know, when he's talking about the ceremony of elevation, it just seemed like such a numinous religious work to me, even in the fourth grade, that I was instantly attracted to the voice, even though there were many things that were mysterious or difficult for a reader that young, that really spoke to me in a way that books hadn't before. So I'd say, you know, I got the third and fourth volume from the library soon after I read them. And I didn't read Earth for many years because I think this was before its publication.
Oh, actually. Yeah.
So, you know, I was a child, but I bought it, I think, when it came out, and then it was still a couple years before I actually read it. So for me, you know, that early mystery, and there's nobody to talk about it with. My parents don't really read science fiction or anything like that. So it's like you're in this vacuum and you're just reading all this different stuff, but it always just had this innate appeal to me. And then in, the 90s, when I was in college, I found at the time it was the Whirl and the Earth mailing list, and I read some of that for a little while before I started to post on it. But there's finally someone to talk about
this
stuff with. You know, it had been years and years. But I also remember there was one more brief moment, I think it was maybe in 1994 or so, where I walked in a bookstore and I saw that there was the omnibus Shadow and Claw and Sword and Citadel that had been released. And I saw like the dark black cover there, and I'm like, oh man, I can't believe these are out again. in bookstores. And I just remember that excitement of buying them and rereading them at that point when I was still in high school. But yeah, I love reading and rereading Wolf, and I never get sick of it.
Yeah. Well, he's got such a, I don't know how you describe his voice, his authorial voice. Is, I don't know if it's lyrical. It can be very lyrical, but it does feel just profound, you know, just when you're reading him, he just has this voice, which makes everything, you know, which makes the good stuff really good. And when he's talking about, you know, really depressing, disturbing stuff, it makes it that much worse, right? It's like the way he writes the stories, his authorial voice, it's like mild. It's like he's kind of got like this mild sort of pastoral voice. Mm-hmm. But it's like the Treebeard, you know, it's like Treebeard in book form, right? So like Treebeard with his eyes, you know, that contain like 1,000 years of knowledge or whatever, from Lord of the Rings, but it's Wolf in book form. So it's like, it's mild on the surface. It kind of goes slow, but then it just contains all this depth to it. And I've never read anybody like Wolf. The only one who maybe comes close, well, no, not even, I don't think anybody, like I was going to say like Lafferty or something, but Lafferty is complete. He's very different.
The tone of Lafferty is so, you know, like he's somebody telling a story and a folktale, you know, like he kind of, I think, is more set in that particular tone of the tall tale in that tradition. Whereas Wolf, like he's always trying to do, I think, something a little bit different, even though his basic ethos and his basic strategy for like, okay, I'm going to hide this detail, I'm going to construct this in such a way, he's always doing something a little bit different tonally or thematically that makes it seem like, you know, sometimes you're like, is it the same author that wrote Book of the New Sun when you read some of his late stuff? You
know,
or even Pandora by Holly Hollander, you read something like that and you're like, this guy writes Shadow of the Torture too. but then some of the same tricks, you know, that he employs, they're always there, even in that very late stuff.
Yeah.
You can still see it there.
So I guess we should go maybe into Wolf a little bit. So who was Gene Wolf, you know, as a person? What's his background? What are the famous things that he wrote?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, when you look at 20th century authors, sometimes their biographies are kind of like, well, he was an English teacher. And that's not the case with Gene Wolf. You look at it here, and he seems to have had, you know, kind of an interesting career path. So, you know, he goes to college, right? He drops out, as far as I remember, and then he's drafted into the Korean War, where I think he serves duty as a cartographer in some points. Hmm. Then he returns to school later for engineering, and he starts working for Procter & Gamble, and he works on the machine that basically makes the, you know, Pringles potato chip, right? He's one of the designers of that particular machine there. And there's several. It's not like it's just him, right? There's mm-hmm. there's a team that are working on the different components right there, but he's one of the design elements. And so in his personal life, you know, there's basically one big romance that dominates it. He knew his wife Rosemary when he was a small child. He was born in New York, but then he lived in Texas and Illinois. So, you know, his father was a traveling salesman, more or less, who was gone a lot of the time. And so he was alone with his mother as an only child a lot. But, you know, there was this friendship that developed with Rosemary. And then when they kind of met up again years later, she had kind of that profound influence on him returning from the war. Mm-hmm. You know, he's known as a Catholic writer, but his family he described as being laxly Presbyterian when he was growing up. So he is an adult convert, and primarily, you know, he did convert because this is Rosemary's religion, right? He chose to convert. He married her. They had 4 children, and he worked as kind of an industrial engineer for many years before he found an editing position with Plant Engineering. And in the meantime, right, he was trying to make extra money for his family. And so he's writing these stories, you know, and like the interesting thing about Gene is that whenever he talks about his work, he makes it sound almost like it's banal. He's like, oh, I just need some extra money. And I was working on the table that was broken. And Rosemary said, you better get back in there and write another story. Right? So it's almost like the inspiration there is purely mundane and practical. And yet he creates this artistic stuff that really, you know, is this going to make him the most money possible, or is it something else that he's achieving with his work? Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of all over the place with that, because Gene Wolfe's not an easy person to classify. He wrote with such depth, with such a wide variety of skills and such a unique voice. And yet, you know, you look at his life here, and it seems kind of like a traditional ordinary story of just this normal guy who has this day job. And then eventually, you know, it wasn't until New Sun that he was able to retire from plant engineering and then commit the rest of his life to just writing. So he wasn't, yeah, you know, a full-time writer until much, much later. He'd wake up in the morning and he'd write for a couple hours. Mm-hmm. He produced something like Book of the New Sun with that schedule.
Yeah. Wow. And then when he retired, there are a lot of writers out there, and I'm not one of them. I'm not a writer. Not a fiction, I guess. Maybe at some point, but I have young children, right? And a lot of writers who have young children struggle with that. So when Gene Wolfe retired from Procter & Gamble, how old was he and how old were his children?
Okay. So, yes. So retiring from Procter & Gamble, let's say like this is the early 80s. So if he's born in 1931, he was already in his 50s.
Okay. You know? Okay.
So yeah, he's not necessarily.
He's not changing diapers, getting up in the middle of the night. And yeah.
But during his writing in the 60s and 70s, he definitely, you know, was dealing at times with, yeah,
so he
with
did
children.
It. He did it both ways. He had the full-time job writing on the side, family, kids, and then he was able to kind of, as they say, make it big or whatever, you know, enough to retire from his job and write full-time. Okay, interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and that was a little bit late in life for him, you know.
I think. 50. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Lafferty didn't start till he was about that age too, I think. He was never married as far as I know.
Right, he wasn't.
Right. So yeah, it's like if you can wait till you're 50 and, you know, start writing like Lafferty, or you can kind of like do it, you know, when you have a family and stuff. And yeah, another author I really, really admire is Sigurd Undset, Norwegian Catholic writer who her husband left her, or they got a divorce or something like that. And she had four boys to raise on her own. And so she'd get up well before they got up and then wrote while she smoked, you know, and then, you know, took care of them during the day and put them to bed and then wrote some more, you know. And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of work, especially for a mom. That's I mean, because like you not only like men don't have all of the, I mean, we, not to be like PC, but we're not as emotionally attached to the children, you know. That's weird. I'm not going to say that. Never mind.
No, it's okay to say it. I think that it takes a while to get the feel for fatherhood. It takes a while for that to develop. Yeah. Like, there's I think there is something innately biological.
I love my kids. I'm just going to say that. Yes, I love my kids. But you know, I don't know.
But I think
Aaron's not prepared to talk about male female relationships on the podcast. That's what this is.
Yeah. So, you know, the social response, now though, this does apply to Gene Wolfe's work, cuz one of the frequent criticisms of his work is actually the way that he presents female characters and their, you know, agency compared to the males. But one of the defenses that I always throw out there is, hey, look at what happens to male characters like Sherby. If you're talking about, you know, a woman being a sexual object, guess what, right? Man, sometimes these boys or male characters are treated pretty much equally. I think the difference is that since he deals with archetypes so much, there's just a greater variety of archetype when it comes to male roles, you know.
Yeah.
Like if you're dealing with soldier, thinker, scholar, all these professions that you can deal with there. And he does occasionally descend into allegory and archetype, and I think that's something else that's so attractive for some readers but not all. And I'm not saying a facile allegory where one thing equals something else,
right,
but a kind of difficult allegory that suffuses his fiction there.
Right.
So we can always come back to that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that his family life, and I am not a critic who's interested in Wolf's family life as it applies to his work. I'm interested in him as a person, but biography is not really something that I apply a lot. But I got to tell you, I do see that there's a lot of that in Book of the Short Son and the relationships between that father figure and the difficulty that he has with some of his children there. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of that really does come from personal experience. And there's another short story, The Adopted Father, which I think is, you know, it's definitely worth reading. I didn't appreciate this story until I understood the metaphor and the intent behind it, because this guy, the main character, kind of creates amusement parks. He designs them and he sits there and he spends all his time designing them, and his family doesn't really appreciate it or care about it, but he's looking for someone who he can have fun with, you know, and kind of share all that he has to know. And he thinks, there's no way these are my kids. But then he realizes by the end that maybe, children of the mind and of the spirit is a relationship that can be formed just as fruitfully as one of the body. So I think that definitely informs also his personal life, but I don't want to get into that too much.
Right. There's I mean, I think when you psychologize the author, where you like yeah. Well, what childhood trauma was inspiring this story or whatever, there can be some useful stuff with. Obviously, they come from a family. They come from a background, a history. They, you know, they're going to put themselves in their work. But I think you run the risk of like turning the author into a mental patient. You know,
yeah.
It's like, well, he's obviously crazy. You know, so it's like, oh, he was. You know, you just read too much into it. It's like, and you might be completely wrong. Like, that's why it's, you know,
right.
Unless you have like good solid evidence, like from their biography or something, or like you or like the author admits, like, yeah, I was pulling from this. You know. It's kind of dangerous to do that. I'm not like against it, but it's when you that's all you do. That's all you do when you're doing trying to, you know, suss out what a work means, you know, then I think that's kind of a one trick pony, you know. I guess what I know this is a really big question, but like, what place does Gene have in literature? Like where is he? Like what is he writing in a tradition? Is he his own unique thing? I mean, I know he had a lot of influences like Chesterton and Proust and authors like that, like Nabokov and stuff. Where is Wolf kind of situated in the literary landscape?
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned Proust, you mentioned Chesterton, you mentioned Nabokov. And I think that all of them, you know, are in that continuum of Wolf's influences, but he's not in the same place that those figures occupy in literary history, because mm-hmm. he's writing about such pulpy things.
Right.
You know, he can't write the great American novel when you have robots and spaceships and, you know, a religious artifact that might resurrect people. That's not Americana, right? It just isn't, right? And so, however, I will say that one of the things that I don't think has been emphasized enough is that Wolf is extremely traditional in his use of allusions, in his reference to things that have gone before. And so when people say that he subverts, I don't think he's a subversive writer at all. I think he wrote those traditions, and that if you knew everything, if you knew all of literary history, if you knew all of religious history, if you knew all the scientific things that he knew, that, you know, he's firmly entrenched in that continuum.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that even though he's not appreciated in, let's say, the standard academy at colleges, where, you know, I'm not going to take English 102 and read a Gene Wolfe story unless, you know, the teacher puts it in there. He's
right.
not going to be
right.
At this point in time in like in one of those compendiums there. I think that he's very important. And I think that he brings a maturity to the genre he's writing in that wasn't previously seen, even though with the new wave you started to see an outgrowth of different philosophies in science fiction. But also, he's writing much more traditionally than those other new wave figures, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not that avant-garde. He really isn't.
Right.
What's interesting about him, though, is that people read him and they're so separated from the tradition that he's writing from. They're so separated from the ethos that he has that they feel as if he might be a part of that avant-garde and that he is subverting so many things.
Right.
So I think that he's a difficult author to place in literary history, because clearly he's well-respected. He's honored. He was famous in his life. But was he as famous as he should have been for what he created? I don't think so. Does he have the place in literary history he deserves? I don't think so. Because, you know, if I go to, like, let's say university, there's a chance that there might actually be a Melville scholar or a Nabokov scholar. Mm-hmm. There's a position for that. If I go to the university and say, hey, I want to be your Gene Wolfe scholar, they might look at me and be like, who?
Right. That? Right.
Right. You know, there's not going to be that kind of teaching position. But if there was, I would hope that they would at least consider me for the role.
Well, as soon as I start my I might believe in Fairies University, you'll have the Wolf position for sure. No, I think that's true. I think part of it is he's newer too. He's a newer author. Part of it is the ghettoization of, you know, genre fiction. And I think even now it's still kind of looked down upon, you know. I mean, I think it's, I don't know, you're more familiar with the world. Is it better now, or?
I will have to say, though, that pop culture is huge in a lot of these literary circles. You know, they're always interested in, like, oh, what comic books are successful and famous right now, because they want to attract students. They want they want people in this career to write about things that are relatable, that they care about, that can still be artistically, you know, they can still have merit artistically, and yet they want to reach a wide audience. And so that's the problem. Wolf has artistic merit, but he really doesn't, I think, often reach the largest possible audience just because, you know. And so I think if we mention his main influences, a lot of them are writing in that pulpy tradition, though. But you go back a little bit further, you know, like Vance the Nightland guy,
Hodgson's.
Hodgson's, you know, those kind of characters, Dunsany. So the older fantasy, I think, definitely did influence him a little bit. But I think he's writing more in the tradition of the 19th century novel to some degree.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like, he's got Dickens in there, and he's got all those famous English authors. I will say, when I ask questions about what he had read and what were his favorite works, he did tend to read a lot that was written in English rather than in translation, even though Proust obviously is huge. So I think that he was more well-schooled in English language art. So I asked, for example, hey, did you ever read The Brothers Karamazov? You know, and he'd read Dostoevsky's shorter stuff, but he hadn't read the entirety of a lot of the long stuff, or, you know, like Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain. Like, he hadn't really read a lot of those long novels that were translated.
So,
you know, like, English literary history, I think, is a huge influence on him. But, you know, we miss out on so many of the things. He was interested in poetry, you know, like, you can find Pope and all those classic romantic poets that are there, you know, like, from all these different periods. Melville, I think, you know, he was well steeped in, but primarily English.
Interesting. I could see that. I'm surprised at the lack of Dostoevsky. But yeah, that's very interesting. So, would you call him a modernist writer? What would that mean then? Oh, sorry.
Okay,
go ahead.
So, for me, right? For me, one of the big distinctions between the latter half of the 20th century is that you move into this postmodern era, and all of a sudden, people are uncertain about universals. They're uncertain about the possibility of communication. And so, while Wolf always flirts with subjectivity, I think when you get to the heart of the matter, he believed in the validity of communication. He believed in the possibility of universal truths.
Yeah.
You know, and so you read this, and for example, one of his early stories, Trip Trap, you know, people are so confounded by this, but it's clear that the reality of that story is the spiritual realm that the two characters share. It actually affects the physical world. Like, when the sword is broken in the dream world, its physical object, it's broken in the real world outside of it. And so, like, there is a reality that you can kind of get to the bottom of. It's just sometimes it's confused by all those subjective perceptions and honestly the ego, right? And so I think a lot of what he's writing about when he has these unreliable narratives is that our ego, our perception, our lies about ourselves can sometimes interfere with our understanding of the real world, because an engineer believes in reality, right? There's a best material for something,
right?
You know, like, we can't make a spaceship out of wood, right? We just can't do it. And so, you know, you can say, oh, whatever you want to use. Well, no, that's not going to work in this particular case. And so I think that his engineering background, his belief in universal principles that are set up there, even if we can't necessarily determine them with our senses right away, make him far more in that modernist tradition where, yes, he's playing with subjectivity, he's playing with the breakdown of societal institutions, but at the same time, there's still a lot that you can get to the bottom of. You know, when he poses an enigma, I think that he has an idea or a thematic concern. And that doesn't mean that every question has to be answered. Sometimes the question is the point.
Right.
Right. Like, what is right and what is wrong and what is good and what is bad? I mean, those are huge questions. But I think at the same time, a postmodernist is a little bit more nebulous. And in my PhD thesis, I made the distinction between an Apollonian creator and a Dionysian one. So I ripped off Nietzsche there, right? But I think that a lot of the postmodern writers are kind of Dionysian in their philosophy and in the way that they compose. And I think that the structured order of Wolf really goes in the other camp a bit more. And so I always see him as a modernist who questions things, but at the same time doesn't question the validity of his art or what he's doing or even his ability to communicate with us.
Right. Well, he always struck me, and reading your stuff has helped me kind of see this too, but he uses a lot of postmodernist techniques to get at the real, you know, basically to point out that human perception can be flawed and subjectivity is a real thing that your perspective is going to be different than mine. And he uses his characters to kind of explore that, but it's never to dismiss things as not real. You know, it's always to say, basically what strikes me as pretty much a standard, you know, realist sort of philosophical approach, like Thomas Aquinas, that we access reality through our senses, but our senses are flawed, right? They don't give us access to all the information, right? The spiritual world we can't access through under normal circumstances, miracles, you know, aside, we can't access the divine realm just by looking under a microscope or something like that. We have to, you know, that's a gift we're given. But he always strikes me as using those postmodern techniques to explore human perception, but never at the expense of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Because you just get that sense when you read him, you know, that there is something going on here, that he is doing something, and it's not just random nonsense that he's compiling, you know.
Yeah.
That goes back to him as an engineer, you know, like you said that, you know, you can't make a spaceship out of wood. There are limits to what we can and can't do. And an engineer knows that. They're probably the most realistic. They should be the most realistic people.
Right.
They should be, you know. I don't know if they all are, but...
And it's like, you know, some of these people see all these puzzles in most fiction, you know, like in Short Sun, there's a scene where a guy's in a forest and he sees something is watching him, you know? And so when I get to scenes like this, guy asks you, okay, what does a forest need in order to be a forest? What's it got to have?
Trees.
Yeah, there you go. Right. So what's watching him? If Wolf doesn't tell you, you know, like maybe the trees are watching. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's that kind of thing, right? Where like the definition of something leads you to certain conclusions.
Right.
And that's kind of the only conclusion. So you gave the answer I was digging for.
Right.
There, right. And that's it. So, you know, I think that so many times people overcomplicate that, where there's like there's a space for an answer. And we can prompt someone to reach it, but we'll come back to that a little bit later.
Yeah, I think when you were talking about how he uses illusions, he is very traditional in how he uses them. If he has Loki in a story, he means Loki to be Loki. You know, Loki's going to be Loki. He's going to be everything Loki is, and use everything that illusion refers to, chaos and, you know, stealing the sun or ushering in Ragnarok or whatever. Like, you know, he's gonna use him in that way, unless he's doing something where he, you know, oh, Loki's upside down or something, you know, it's something like that, where unless something else is going on that would make you question that, right? So, because he does that, I feel like he does that too, where he has an illusion, but then he somehow kind of flips it on its head, right? Or he maybe would misquote something or have an image, you know, like, well, we might talk about this story later, but, and when they appear, the first, apparition that comes to the house is Scrooge, right? But then Scrooge, or Ebenezer Scrooge, and then he introduces himself as Ebenezer, but then the boy, Sherby, thinks he's referring to him, right? That he's
right.
he's Ebenezer.
Yes.
So you're supposed to then start viewing Sherby as a sort of Ebenezer figure, right? That's
right. So, and you know, this is one of those inversions because he's like supposedly young and innocent, and Ebenezer's
right.
like an old, crotchety, stingy guy.
Right.
And they're
right.
both kind of isolated from the society around them.
Right.
And it really does place that boy in that position that he's being visited by spirits and he's going to learn something valuable. But what kind of lesson does that boy learn?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Gosh. Yeah. That is, oh, man. that's a Christmas story, too. It's very.
Yeah.
Uplifting. No, it's not. It's one of the most depressing stories I've ever read in my life. But it is, it is also one of the most profound things I've ever read too. So that's with Wolf. It's like you get it all. You get it all. You get the uplifting, hopeful stuff. Like wow, that was really beautiful and profound. And then you get just the most depraved stuff you could think of in the same story,
right.
You know? And so it's, yeah, we can, well, if there's time, we can get into that story a bit. So Gene uses unreliable narrators. You know, that's what he's kind of famous for. I should say a lot of people say he uses unreliable narrators. It kind of goes into that whole subjective narrator thing we're talking about. Is that an accurate assessment of his work? Like, what would you say to that?
I do think it is, actually,
okay.
But not always the extent of, like, for example, Book of the New Sun, I think Severian's one of the more reliable narrators. People are like, he's lying about this, he's lying about that, you can't believe this scene. I don't get that impression at all. But then, you know, this is one of those cases, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Lawrence Stern's Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, but he wrote it in kind of serialized fashion. And it was so popular that people would do something with it. They would write, like, basically write a new installation and then installment. And then Stern would see that, and if he liked it, he would steal it and use that in his next installment when he wrote it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is something that was, like, self-fulfilling with Wolf. He heard about how unreliable his narrators were, and so they become increasingly unreliable as time goes on.
Yeah.
It's like this self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like, okay, sure. So, for example, the narrative voice in third-person works, like There Are Doors
mm-hmm.
and An Evil Guest, man, there's so much going on that is being not misrepresented, but that's being kind of elided by that third-person narrative voice. And so normally you say, well, an unreliable narrator has motive in what they're – or a reason, like they don't have – they got like a head injury, or they have poor self-knowledge, or they're a pathological liar or whatever
yeah.
it is, or they don't want to be blamed for a crime they committed and they're trying to hide it. Well, those
mm-hmm.
are reasons. But for the third-person stories like There Are Doors and An Evil Guest – what possible reason could there be except that it's just Gene Wolfe's pathology there, you know? Like
right.
It's like, why is this third person unreliable? But I actually feel like I have a pretty good handle on when he does that in the third person because of the motifs and patterns and repetitions. And you can use it to kind of predict, okay, this will happen when this character and this character are together. This kind of thing always happens.
Yeah.
What does it mean? You know, there's a connection there and you can kind of read into that pattern.
Yeah.
And so he has patterns that he's using. So yes, he uses unreliable narrators. And yes, I think if you asked him, he'd say, well, all narrators are unreliable because whenever we tell a story about ourselves, like, for example, if I tell you a story in high school where I got in a fight with some guy, I might make myself out to be slightly better than I was at that particular point, whether in winning the fight
yep.
or in the motivation behind the fight. And, you know, there's that little slant to it.
Yep.
And I think that's realism,
yep.
actually.
Yep.
But, man, Wolf really does take that a little bit far sometimes. Like, you know, you're straining your head because the possibility of in a fantastic work where there could be like an evil spirit that's influencing your perception of reality or casting a spell on you or whatever it is, you know, there's almost an infinite array of possibilities that opens up. And so there has to be things that are closed off over time. And that's actually, I think, one of the key things that makes Wolf difficult to talk about is you're reading it and he has hidden the genre of the work.
Yeah.
So I, for example, New Sun seems fantastic, but in the first chapter, you've already got like a flyer and laser beams. And, you know, you read a little bit more and there's like a communication system in the top of the tower that like it talks to other towers there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's extant technology.
Right.
Right. That's still there, but it's poorly understood by the people who are employing it. And so it seems a little bit more medieval than it actually is, at least at the very start. Even though, like I say, right away, there's basically a laser beam
right.
in the first chapter of Shadow of the Torturer. And yet it seems more fantastic than it probably should.
Right. Yeah, it's difficult. One of the reasons I hesitated a long time to do a Gene Wolfe episode, just because he did write a lot, and his genre, like his whole repertoire is so varied, you know, that it would be hard to kind of just. I don't know. I feel like there's a bunch of other Gene Wolfe podcasts out there, and then they take like an episode, or like they take one book and they make it make 10 episodes out of it. You could do that. You can do that with his books. That's what makes it so. It's not like they're just, you know, farming content. You know, it's like each chapter of Peace has to be, you know, two hour long discussion.
Yes.
Because it's there's just so much in there, and it can be overwhelming. Because he does take all of it. And I thought, you know. My favorite author is Tim Powers. Tim Powers is not as good a writer as Gene Wolfe, and I will admit that. I think Powers would probably admit that too. But the reason I like Powers more is Powers is more accessible. He just is but he still takes a tons of literary allusions, and he
yes.
grinds them all up and he spits them out, and it makes a very interesting story, very very cool story. But Wolfe is just like on another level, you know, and. But part of the trick is figuring out what story Wolfe is telling you, and what sort of allusions the allusions he has and the patterns kind of tell you what the story is. Like Peace is a ghost story, you know, but you don't know that the first time you read it, right? But then you start looking up, and the internet is a wonderful thing, because then you can just kind of Google all these things, you know. Like I'm the best Wolfe scholar in the world because I had the internet after all the other Wolfe scholars had it. No.
Right. Well, the thing is, though, that you read some, and you know, from my position of being so opinionated about everything, you read some stuff online, like even the Wikipedia entry on Long Sun, for example, and you're like, no, you want to scream at it. No, you've got it all backwards. What's going on here? But I don't want to imply that there really is a right and a wrong way to read something you enjoy. And so all this talk about Gene's difficulty, I think, does him a little disservice in that some of his books are just fun to read, whether you get them or not. So The Sorcerer's House, for example, you can have a ton of fun, and you may never have heard of the Lamia of Corinth or know anything about what the Lamia of Corinth can do and what she will do given her powers, like, because that's one of the backbones that forms some of the patterns in the novel. And once you see that, you're like, oh, okay, a house. Oh, that's what it's for. You know, you have this Ur story behind it, but you don't need to know it to enjoy the book.
Right. And
you don't need to know you don't even need to get a lot of the Christian imagery in New Sun to
right.
enjoy that as an adventure story. You really don't. It can be completely relieved of that context
right.
and still be a good book that you enjoy. And actually, that's one of the things that Wolfe said at when he was named Grand Master at the Nebula Awards in, I think, 2014, I believe it was that year. Where
Sounds right, yeah.
2013.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yeah, 2013. Somewhere around there.
Yeah,
right. At it. But, you know, the decades pass, and you're like, oh, gosh. But Kim Stanley Robinson was happy to win Best Novelist or Best Novel that year because he got to talk about Gene. You know, that was really neat. And then Gene came up there and he gave his speech, and he said, at the end of the day, I want someone to point at this and say, that was a good book.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's important, too, that he did write to entertain and to be enjoyed. And I, you know, it's a shame sometimes to say, well, he's not accessible to the masses, or they'll never understand him, or blah blah blah. Because I think he wanted to write something that people would love to read and reread, and so
he just takes more work than other authors. I think you can do it. And you can. That's what's nice about his stories. Is they're a pleasure to read, no matter if you understand them or not. I'm sure I miss 90% of what he's doing in a story. The prose is wonderful, and he's got such a nice authorial voice that he's just a pleasure to read. And I think half the fun is then going back and reading it again and going, okay, what is this when this character says that, okay, what does that mean? And or this character is named, you know, Dennis Weir, what does that mean? You know, or Severian, oh, there's like a bunch of different, you know, meanings behind that name, you know, like what does he mean? He means all of them. You know, so it's, and then how does that play out in the story? Like, you know, it's you read enough wolf stories and you sort of get an understanding of how to read a wolf story. But I guess that kind of goes into another question I have on here. So how would you give advice on how to read a wolf story?
Well, I think the first time, you know, I think most people agree with me, just read it, you know, just read the book the first time. If you want to take notes, whatever it is. If there's something that confuses you, write it down. But in general, that first pass through, you're going to see the destination at the end that you didn't know was coming. Mm-hmm. And then I recommend, you know, read it again and you'll see that it's not just foreshadowing that Wolf does. He's a very, it's like this super subtle foreshadowing that transforms your understanding of events. And so, for example, in Book of the New Sun, there's a kind of a throwaway line at the start where he comes across this dog, Triskel, and it says he was the smallest of those dead. But then he immediately kind of lifts his head and licks Severian's hand and stuff like that. So obviously the context of that originally was, okay, he can't be dead because he seemed dead. But then when other things, when you go back, he was the smallest of those dead. When you go back and read it a second time, after you see everything that's happened in the story and you know that resurrections are possible in this, it opens up new possibilities that weren't there before.
Yeah.
And so I think that second read, you could pause at sentences like that and be like, wait a minute, he was the smallest of those dead, literally, right?
Yeah,
Is that meant literally?
Right.
So that transforms the scene in a way. But you didn't have that knowledge beforehand.
Right.
That these kind of powers were even something that existed in the world there.
Right.
And so I think that that's the coolest part about rereading Wolf is you see, oh gosh, based on later events, this literal meaning might be what's actually meant here.
Right.
And so, you know, you just dismiss it as metaphorical, but oftentimes I think it's not.
He's writing science fiction and fantasy. So like, you know, that's where the metaphorical becomes literal, you know, So, I think with Wolf, you kind of forget that sometimes you're reading one of his stories like, oh, right. And there's like an alien here. Right. I'm reading, this is a science fiction story, so there's got to be something science fictional about it, or it's just, you know, straight realism. And so it's kind of like, sometimes it's kind of jarring when you're reading a wolf story like that, and you remember that it's a wolf story, right? It's not just this nice, you know, pastoral story you're reading about, you know, this hardworking guy, you know. I'm thinking of like La Bafana, you know, where this, you know, this creature comes home from a hard day of toiling, you know. It's like he's got six legs and he's a fur, you know.
and it's about the coming of Christ to a world where he hasn't come before.
Right. Yep. That's a more hopeful story. Yeah, I like that one. Yeah. I mean, I've enjoyed, so I guess I'll say how I kind of came to Wolf. I had heard about him shortly before he passed away in 2019. It was maybe a year or so before that. And people were talking about him. I can't remember where. It was in a Catholic context. Like somebody through, I think it was through one of Joseph Pierce's websites or blogs, like had wrote about Book of the New Sun or something like that. And I'm like, oh, interesting. Okay. And then blogs like, oh, what, you know, there are Catholic books. What are like Catholic science fiction books? And like Gene Wolfe is mentioned and like John C. Wright's mentioned him. And, you know, I'm like, okay. So I look him up and I'm like reading reviews and I'm like, oh boy, this guy seems pretty out there and weird and dark. And I don't know if I'll like him. And then I picked up the fifth Head of Cerberus. And I read it and I'm like, what the hell was that? Like, I'm like, that was depressing and really sexual and weird, and I'm not a fan of this guy. And I was like, I'm gonna get rid of this book. And then a little voice in my head was like, no, just keep it on the shelf, just, you know, don't get rid of it yet, just keep it there for now, and you might change your mind later. And so I'm like, fine. So I kept it. And then shortly after he passed away, I'm like, okay, I'll pick up on him again. And then I read Book of the New Sun, and I was like, this is amazing. This is amazing. Yeah, it's dark. Yeah, it's really, there's some stuff in there that's really unpleasant. But it's, I had never read anything that, like, profound before, you know, other than, like, I don't know, maybe Chesterton, you know, and some of Chesterton stuff. Or, yeah, so, and then I'm like, okay, so I'm glad I kept the fifth head, you know? So that's kind of how I came to him. So
yeah, that's kind of almost a condemnation. Like, you read it and you're like, I got to throw this away. That's a pretty fascinating response.
But I didn't throw it away. No, you know, I wanted to.
You didn't, yes.
You're like, there's okay. A little voice in my head. A little part of me was just like, no, you probably just don't understand it. So just put it back on the shelf and, like, just forget about it for now. And maybe you'll come back to it. And I'm like, okay, fine. And then I'm like, okay. And I still don't really like Fifth's Head that much. I don't enjoy it, but I really appreciate it as a story. You know, it's not, I don't think, like, it's such a depressing story. Like, I.
Yes, and so that's another thing, though. You know, you think, okay, Gene Wolfe has these Catholic beliefs that are going to be shown in the story, and yet throughout the Fifth Head of Cerberus, there's so much that almost works against free will, right?
Yeah.
You're like, wow, this highly determined society. But I think this is another case of unreliable narration. Mm-hmm. There's a moment at the end of that first novella where the glass, you hear this sound of breaking glass, and he goes in. I'm going to spoil. Should we not spoil things on this podcast?
Well, that came out in, like, the 70s, so I think it's fair game.
Okay, goodness. So there's a point where he goes in there, and he's determined to complete the cycle of killing his father and basically becoming his father.
Right, right.
You know? Mm-hmm. But I think that's a choice that he makes, and I think that this is playing out a choice.
Yeah.
They continue to make the bad decisions that lead to the stagnation.
Right.
So I think that there's still room for free will in the cycle there, but that his authorial... The narrative voice seems to say, oh, no, I'm trapped. That's it. I can't do anything differently. Yes, you can. You're in charge now.
Right.
Do something different, right?
Right.
But he's trapped in that cycle because of the decisions that he makes. And so I think that Wolfe's willingness to go inside the heads of certain characters and see things from their point of view can make it seem so bleak and depressing and inescapable that you want to just, like, I got to escape this by throwing the book away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Away and going somewhere else.
Right. Well, I think that's part of why he gets some criticism too, because he's so good at, you know, writing from other perspectives that are not his, like Severian and his problems with women, let's say, where it's just so, and Wolfe isn't, like, it's not that these books are, like, full of gratuitous sex scenes or anything like that. They're it's very subdued, but there's something about it that's just very unsettling, you know? And I think people pick up on that because Wolfe is so good at, he's just so good at writing from that perspective, like from different perspectives. Like, cause you read like Stephen King or like George R. R. Martin, and they have like nobody
way more graphic.
They're way above and beyond, you know, what's necessary, but it's like, people don't, I mean, maybe some people level the same criticisms at them, but that's something I hear about Wolfe pretty frequently. It's like, oh, he's a sexist, you know, or he, like, the way he writes about women is just, like, gross. I'm like, yeah, it's unpleasant, but it's, and it's not even just women. I mean, that's a, you know, it's like you said too, like, there are men who are, like, become sexual prey for, you know, other people. And there are women who are not, right? And they have agency and they're really interesting characters. So he's really got a wide range. And I think it's an unfair criticism. But it is interesting because I'm like, you read, I think there's something about the way he is writing because he's usually writing from from the character's perspective.
Yes, and there's so much philosophizing about it. Like, oh, men love that which they destroy. And, you know, when you enter a woman and blah, blah, blah. Like the explicit philosophizing makes it overt rather than just a gratuitous sex scene. It's not a gratuitous sex scene.
Right.
It's the philosophy on top of the sex scene.
Right.
That makes you think, okay, this is really a point of view that maybe Wolfe has.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Yeah. They like, no, that's Severian who was raised by torturers, remember, and his only experience with women were either witches or prostitutes. So it's like he doesn't have a great way to start.
The relationship between males and females is like that between us and our clients. They call them clients,
right?
But really, they're not clients, they're people being tortured,
right?
by that institution there. They don't, right. It's not like, can I get a refund on this? Right? Like, right. You know, well, bad customer service.
Well, and it's kind of like with Book of the New Sun, you know, the Torturers Guild referring to their clients as clients. That's kind of what prostitute, they refer to their, their Johns or whatever as clients, clientele, you know? And so it's kind of like this, rationalization, glossing over the actual brute fact of actually, no, you're torturing that person, or you are using your body as a piece of meat, you know, and you're just kind of rationalizing it away. It's like, oh, this is my client. It's like, well, no, they're the person who is, you know, raping you, or this is, you know, you are, you know, cutting off this person's fingers and saying that it's, you know, business or something. Or
I will have to say, even as a child, for whatever reason, the stuff in Wolf never bothered me at all. Mm-hmm. You know, like I never had a visceral reaction against it. I don't know if it's just me or what it is, or I'm used to how my dad talked about things, you know, whatever it is, but like it doesn't seem. Now, that's the other thing. I feel like Wolf has a very particular sensitive masculinity where it's definitely masculine. Like the outlook on so many things, I would say, yes, this is a masculine writer writing here. I mean, he has the way that he thinks about everything. But even though there's brutishness, there's always like this philosophical sensitivity where it's the kind of guy who will like, you know, gosh, I got in a fight and I had to curb stomp this guy, but then I cried about it later. You know, like it's like this, there's some depth there,
yeah.
Even in the most brutish things, and yet there's still brutishness.
Right.
It's not like, you know, oh, I was paralyzed. Even though Stavarian is at times paralyzed into inaction, there's still times when he acts and does things that we might think are horrific and glosses over them. But I never really had a problem with that because I guess maybe that's how inside I can be too, you know, like it's like, okay, there's a violent reaction, and then my ego later will think about something. I'll be like, boy, I shouldn't have done that.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I think it's just the way he's very philosophical in his writing. And I think people will will look at like Severian and go, oh, it's just male power fantasy, you know. And it's like, well, yeah, it is, but it's Severian's male power fantasy, not Gene Wolfe's, you know. It's like it's like Wolfe is, you know, a loving husband and father. He's not going around torturing people with a big sword and, you know, doing whatever to people. So it's, yeah, it's
he's torturing people with a pen.
That's right. I think Neil Gaiman said something like, you know, like it's a knife throwing contest reading Gene Wolfe and Gene's throwing the knives at you, you know, or something like that. So, something like that. But yeah, he can, the way he writes, it's like the blade of a sword, you know, it can be very sharp and very pointed. And some of it is very direct. Like he engages in, difficult subjects very, very directly some of it is disgusting just by the brute fact of it. Right. But he's not indulging it.
No, it doesn't seem like, okay, he's almost getting off on graphic depictions of it. No, it's, and like, even then some of the most explicitly sexual scenes, like, where, you know, Severian's with Jolentin,
oh gosh,
son,
yeah.
And then there's that unhatched, a freshly hatched chick, right? Which is probably the grossest description I can possibly imagine.
It is hardest scene to get through. I actually skipped it. I couldn't do it. I'm like, I can't read this. So there are points where I'm like, this might be too much for me, but like, I get what he's doing there. It's all very symbolic, you know, all of it is heavily archetypal, you know, but it's still like the fact of it is still difficult to get through. And I don't fault anybody for reading Wolf and bouncing off of him. Like, I don't fault anybody for that. He's a difficult author, but I always get the sense that he's like, he's not reveling in it, but he's like, come with me. We have to look at this. We have to look at the hard facts of life. And it's like a father showing a child, like, this is what happens. You know, this is what happens when bad stuff happens. Bad stuff can happen. And this is what it looks like. And it's not pretty. You know, that's kind of the sense I get. You know, he's like, this is how life is sometimes. And he just has a very, like you said, he's a very sensitive but masculine voice. He's got kind of the voice of a father, you know, when he's writing.
Yes.
And and that's a father should be a masculine but sensitive, you know, sort of presence. Mm-hmm. And so I think he does kind of embody that just in his authorial voice. Maybe that's what it is when I was thinking about it earlier, because that just kind of came into my head. I'm like, well, what's masculine but also sensitive? Well, it should be a father, you know?
Father.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like he'll show you wonders and he'll show you depravity, you know?
It's for your own good.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to smoke this whole carton of cigarettes. It's for your own good. so, yeah. What else? I guess another thing, we kind of talked about this a little bit, just his experience as an engineer. His stories, you said he's, I can't remember the name.
Apollonian?
Apollonian. Apollinarian. I think that's a type of dog.
Whatever the word is, yeah.
I think, he's very structured in his writing. Does that come from his engineering background?
Oh, yes, I think so. And I think that also rewriting, you know, he rewrites and rewrites and rewrites. And so honestly, I mean, okay, so I'm going to book a very late example, An Evil Guest, mm-hmm. right? So I was looking at this book and I was stymied by it. I read it like 8 times in a row. And I'm like, I know there's something I can get at here. And then I realized when I read the first chapter, the characters are in a white house. And, you know, the main character, you know, it's like he's being assigned a task to spy on someone. He's not really the main character, but he seems to be in that first chapter in mm-hmm. Gideon Chase. And then I looked at the final chapter and they're in a different white house, and there's a guy who has lost a lot of weight, and he shows a picture that is like a picture of the same person that a picture was shown of in the first chapter, but it's set before his time as ambassador, and the other one is like after his time as ambassador. So the time is kind of reversed. But then I realized that the two situations were exactly parallel, and that this guy who had lost a lot of weight was kind of in the same position of the character at the start. And then I realized something about – I learned something about the story by realizing that structure was there. Mm-hmm. It actually told me something, because the things that seemed so random at the end of the story weren't random, because I was supposed to apply them to the character in the first chapter, because they call this guy who lost weight a reformed dragon. And then I realized the guy in the first chapter was a reformed dragon too, who had lost a whole lot of weight. And so like I understood all of a sudden, like because of the structure.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not something you can even explain on a conscious level. You know, it's just like all of a sudden it
just
popped into focus.
Yeah.
And every single scene in that novel, I realized its structural placement, the way that it kind of was a metaphor or a commentary on another scene in the novel. Like, it's so super structured that it's almost not even a novel. It's something else.
Yeah.
Really. But not all his works are like that, but there's always a sense of structure.
Mm-hmm.
And the juxtaposition of two things that don't seem to be related, sometimes if they occur over and over and over again, then you know that they actually are related. There's a reason that they're conjoined there. That's engineering. That's scaffolding. That's something that, you know, even like it's super structured.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's something Gregorio Montejo and I talked about, comparing Lafferty to Wolf, and Wolf
mm-hmm,
is
yes.
the very much the engineer, you know, and Lafferty is more Shaggy Dog, folktale.
Yeah.
You know, they liked each other's books, but they're very different authors in their approach. And like, I always like to think of Gene Wolfe, Lafferty, and Tim Powers is kind of the three weird Catholic authors of the mm-hmm. like the late 20th century. And Powers, like, he doesn't really do the same. He's not doing the same thing that Wolfe is doing. He's not really doing the same thing as Lafferty's doing. He's more of like a historian than author, you know, because his whole approach is completely different than anybody else's. He's like taking historical events and then weaving supernatural things around them. And so that makes the stories very odd too. Like the shape of them is very odd because he's trying to work around the history. And it reads more like a cold case detective, like, you know, story than anything else, which is very entertaining and interesting. And he's also doing things with the sacraments and like, and one thing I like about Wolf and Powers and Lafferty is their use of names. The names usually mean something. And with Wolf, names are huge. Like to name something, something's name in a Wolf story is always meaningful in some way. Powers is the same thing. Not as much to the same extent, but he still does. And so I like to think of those three guys as kind of like the weird American Catholic science fiction authors, like the trilogy or the trio, those three. So I guess, let's see. So Wolf's fans, truth be told, I was on the Facebook group for a long time, and I stopped because it just got to be too like weird and too like political and just odd. But Wolf is, you know, from what I understand, Wolf fans can be very opinionated and very, there can be contentions and different theories as to what's going on. So why is that? Why are his fans so, why do they seem to be so, dedicated, let's say?
Well, I think the compelling thing about people who write like Wolf, you know, where there seems to be space for interpretation, mm-hmm. is that you can bring so much of yourself to the text. You see something interesting, you're like, wait a minute, this has to be it. And so then it becomes a personal interpretation that you think is objective truth. It's kind of funny. It's like a microcosm of the concerns that Wolf is like, where your subjective perceptions get in the way of the truth. Well, you know, that happens with the readership too there. You know, the subjective perceptions become so, so important to you, your reading of it. And then you start to argue about what actually happened or what it means. And so you get caught up in that. And that's happened to me. I mean, circa 2002, 2003, when Short Sun came out on the Earth List. Oh my gosh. I mean, you've never seen the visceral reactions to just saying like, hey, I think this happened. Oh, you're a jerk. You deserve to die. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know? And yet I've engaged in the same kind of contentions. I've argued with people passionately about it. And so I think it's because you bring so much of yourself into the interpretation of what he invites you to.
Right.
And that's why you take it so personally. Because you're like, can't you see it? It's right there on the page. And then you're like, no, it's not there on the page, buddy. It's in your head.
Right.
You know? And I think that happens with any writer that leaves a lot of gaps or spaces, but that since it seems that there is so much cohesion in a Wolf story, so much investment in traditional narratives and characterization and plot, that, you know, that investment brings that personal regard for all aspects of the text, especially mm-hmm. the most popular ones. So people are going to argue, you know, it's just the way it is. But also now, right, it seems as if it's very rare to agree to disagree with the totalizing kind of factions that we have in politics and philosophy, like where you have to accept. I remember reading an article a couple years ago when I was teaching at UNLV about how if you are an ally of this, then you need to believe in this, 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 and this. And one of the check marks on a completely unrelated thing was like support Palestine, you know?
Right.
Like, wait a minute. We're not talking about anything national. We're talking about, like, for all intents and purposes, equality. Right?
We're
talking about like the philosophy and like there's this very specific check mark that you have to fill. You have to believe mm-hmm. this. And so I think that the totalizing rhetoric that we have right now, where it's kind of all or nothing, buy into it or don't buy into it.
Right.
And if you don't buy into it, you must be an enemy. I think that this contributes as well to some of those political contentions that you see.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember, you know, being at Notre Dame and my favorite professor there who wrote me a recommendation letter for graduate school, Professor Buttigieg, who is the father of the guy who ran for president.
Oh, wow.
You know, Joseph Buttigieg. I loved his class. You know, and his life work was kind of translating Antonio Gramsci's, you know, he was imprisoned in Italy for standing against Mussolini. The philosophies, the life philosophies that Professor Buttigieg and I have are completely different. The teaching strategies that Buttigieg and I have are completely different. And yet, in the 90s, it seemed entirely possible to ask him for a sincere reference letter and to love his class and to love him as a professor.
Even
philosophically, we're not the same. We don't have to be the same.
Right.
We can take completely different approaches to literature. And you know, I don't have to read it the way that he does. It can be something different. And so I think a lot of that has been lost, mm-hmm. you know, and it's unfortunate because you can learn a lot from everybody that you talk to.
Yeah.
And I think it's a shame that you're just shutting off some possibilities there.
Well, when I was in college, it was, both undergrad and graduate school, it was similar. You know, it's like the older professors, even if they, like, I was, you know, conservative Catholic at a very, very liberal school. And the professors I could talk to, because they're like, oh yeah, you know, like, you know, we work with farmers who, you know, basically you're basically like a farmer we work with, and we like them, and so, you know, it's like, you know, so because I worked in like you know, entomology and bees and stuff, and so there's like crossover with like a lot of farming and a lot of, you know, animal husbandry and stuff. So it really you get a wide variety of people. So like the professors I worked with, they had a wide experience. They've met talked to lots of people. They weren't like isolated in their little silos. You know, some of them were, but they were kind of the exception. But then you get to like the students, you know, the students are a different animal, you know, where it's like, you're either with us or against us. You know, you're either you're checking off all the boxes, like you were saying, and you're an ally, and you believe in all these things. If you don't, we're going to like, you know, burn your house down. You know, so there's definitely, you know, cause the older generation, you know, you can criticize them for whatever you want, and maybe a lot of those are justified, but they at least you can have a conversation with them, you know, you can disagree and they're not going to hate you for it. You know, it's most of them won't, but, people my age, people my age and younger, it's like, you better watch out what you say, because the knives will come out if you say you're, you know, for this or against that. And it's hard to have conversations with people. Even with me, you know, in some of my more conservative and Catholic friends, it's hard to read stuff together, especially if it has, you know, difficult elements in it, you know, and have conversations about that, about works you don't agree with and stuff. It's hard. It's hard for me, you know, it used to be harder for me too. But, you know, I'm not going to say like I've grown or anything stupid like that, but it's, you know, you just read more and, things aren't as shocking, I guess. But you know, it's everywhere. It's not just isolated in like, oh, it's those liberals or anything like that. It's kind of all over the place. It's like polarization. And so I think that kind of filters down into like Gene Wolfe too, where it's like you get people, it's like a self-selecting group, like the people who are really hardcore political about whatever thing. Well, also they also happen to like Wolfe. Well, they're going to bring that right into the conversation with Wolfe, and they're going to paint Wolfe whatever color they want, you know. And it's like you bring in your own perspective, and it's what you always do with a book you read. But you got to be careful, because with Wolfe, it's like, how much are you reading into the text, and how much of that is actually you reflected back at you, you know? The Wolfe conversations are always fun, because you get people who are really hardcore fans, and hopefully they like each other, you know? It's like they can have conversations, and, you know, like we were talking about, and when they appear on Twitter a little bit, and there's different interpretations of what's going on, and it's all very interesting. You know, I learn a lot with those conversations, even if people disagree. So, so that's pretty much that. I guess maybe a couple more things here. We kind of talked about this already, but, just a little bit more. So like Gene, like for a conservative Catholic like myself, there's a whole like contingency of conservative Catholics who really love Gene Wolfe, and so it's not like this unheard of thing, but there's a lot of difficult stuff in Wolfe, and it's kind of like with Flannery O'Connor. I think when she was asked like, why don't you just write nice books, you know, you know, and so Wolfe, he's Catholic, you know, very devout Catholic, and a husband and a father, but he writes some freaking depressing stories and stories that have very difficult subject matter, especially sexually, in them. Like in Book of the New Sun, does he use sexuality in like a symbolic way for the themes of the book? Because I always read it as like he is reuniting the sexual act with the with life, you know, with giving life.
Yes.
You know, where the modern world has like divorced those two things, and Wolfe, in his own weird way, is like bringing them back together in very fruitful ways, you know, to make a pun, I guess. So is he doing that in Book of the New Sun?
Oh, yeah. I think that in Earth of the New Sun, this is actually explicit there, where Severian starts thinking about, I had desired women so often because I wanted to engender something, you know, that sexual act, it means something, but it's devoid of any future in that I don't want to call it a post-apocalyptic landscape, but in that environment of desuetude and kind of dereliction where everything is run down, nothing's working, the sun is dying, right? Society has forgotten where it's come from, and it's kind of just everything's winding down. Mm-hmm. There's no bright future for humanity in it, and there's no real fecundity, right? When you have a resurrection, it's of like a grandmother figure and not of something new that's coming.
Right.
And so even the sexuality is tied up in that. It's like a groping towards the past fertility.
Right.
But something different has to come from it. So I think it's really, really symbolic, especially in New Sun.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, it's not fruitful until, you know, he goes to Yasod and there's that, you know, talk about gravidity and bringing something new into the world. And he says, finally, that terrible urge had left me. So once he accomplishes that, the sexuality diminishes, his urges diminish, the kind of the act devoid of its meaning is shed a little bit. And so I think that, yeah, New Sun especially, the sexuality is serving multiple purposes.
Yeah.
But so are so many of the symbols in that, whether that be water, whether that be
right.
the light of the sun, whether that be the golden coin, right? It's all kind of tied up together, and sexuality is a part of that that some readers might be uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
I'm not one of them and never have been, even
right.
when I was a child, because I don't think it's explicit. I don't think it's ever for the point of obscenity
right.
or titillation even, but I think it serves the purpose. And, you know, let's be honest, that's a part of life too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of life, and it doesn't always go according to plan. You know, like
right.
things happen. And so I think that Wolf uses all of that in his fiction. But yeah, it does serve a purpose.
Yeah, that's what I noticed, too, especially with Severian, you know, basically, you know, in his relationship with Dorcas, who turns out to be spoilers, who turns out to be his grandmother. Right. It's like basically he's trying to he resurrects the dead. Right. And it's his grandmother and he's like, you know, sleeping with her and stuff. But it says ultimately this is not fruitful. Right. You can't
yeah.
like resurrect the past to revive the future. You know, it's like and it, well, you see that with like Typhon, too. When he, you know, is basically masturbating, it's not, you know, again,
yeah.
it's not obscene. It's but it's implied, you know, and it's basically he's a satanic figure, and he can't do anything. He can't reproduce. All he can do
yeah.
is, you know, mindlessly. It's like Satan, you know, Satan
yeah.
in Dante, you know.
Yeah.
All he can do is beat his wings mindlessly. It's all he can do, and so Wolf is very much implying. Like it's really they're very moral books, you know.
Yes.
And he's tying sexuality back to its purpose in very weird ways. But I think that's what he's doing. And I've had this theory for after I read Book of the New Sun. You know, I'm trying to like, okay, what's going on with all this sexual imagery? Because it's very prevalent in Book of the New Sun.
Yeah, it is.
And I'm like, something's going on here, right? So it's not just, you know, people like, oh, Severian's just a, you know, by extension, Wolf is just a pervy guy, you know? It's like, well, no, I mean, Severian is. but it's still like Severian.
Yeah, I feel like this must be, I don't know, the people that they hang out with. Because when I was going to the gym regularly, there were guys in there who would be like, yeah, I've been with 125. You know
yeah.
what I mean? Like
mm-hmm,
something
yep.
just ridiculous. And it's like.
Yeah, I've met Severians in real life.
I mean, come on. Severian is a handful of women over the course of these books.
Really. Yeah, well, that's true.
Like,
his conquests are relatively conquests. I shouldn't say conquests. His exploits are relatively tame compared to some people I've known. You know, it's like, yeah, I've met that guy at the gym. You know, he, you know. Where it's like, oh, I was with this guy or this girl, she was 50, you know, and I'm like, dude, like I was working with him on a job site. I was back before I started grad school. And I'm like, dude, I don't want to hear this. Like, this is disgusting. I don't want to hear about your STDs. I don't want to hear about your weird, you know, relationships with other older women. I don't care about that. I don't care. Like, please leave me alone.
And so, but the thing is that Wolf, you know, usually has these themes that he's working with. And so one of the big criticisms of, like, for example, Wizard Knight, you've read that, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, the scene where the giants are reproducing with the human women
mm-hmm.
and the way that it happens, where basically there's giant sperm that are
yeah.
running around. You know, like that's a graphic and disturbing scene for mm-hmm. some readers. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with my reading of the work or not, but that is actually like a symbolic motif that is being played over and over and over again in many of the scenes that you can't otherwise really contextualize.
Right. So
there's a scene at the very start where a character who is named like his ideal, like I think hers is Desiree, and there's Desira. You know, there's a letter difference at the end of it, and she like the character who's not his ideal leaves a child behind, and she's killed. I think her head is split open.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you look at this as the same kind of metaphor, where when you engender new life and conception happens, where like the egg is split open, who would you expect in this to have committed that murder? It is the father who's killed that woman and left the child behind there. Mm-hmm. And then that child disappears, and it doesn't make any sense in the greater story until you see it as a pattern, as a motif, where you kind of know what happens to the baby that drops down to the lower world there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a pattern, you know. And so the giant sperm is, you know what, I don't want to get into this for it's too specific and graphic, but there's a reason.
Yeah,
there's a reason for that, and it's usually symbolic or thematic, or it reflects on the greater plot. It's not just to be gross.
Right Yeah, I'm familiar with your theory of Wizard Knight, and yeah. We won't get into it here, it's too complicated.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably a good way to understand the sexuality in his books. I think, yeah, because you have books like Game of Thrones, and you have like Stephen King, and you have all these other authors who basically it's there just to show depravity, you know, at its very best, you know, like it's there to basically just say, oh yeah, human beings are wicked and they do bad things, and this is the worst thing they can do. And I'm like, yeah, I get that, but like you don't have to get it so involved into it, right?
And it's never going to transform into anything uplifting or greater in those novels.
No.
It's never going to be, it's never going to reach something beautiful.
Right.
Right. And in Wolf, I think it often does.
Yeah.
I think it transcends the I don't want to call it disgusting particulars. I don't want to call it that at all. But it transcends the particulars into something that's far greater and more numinous and inexplicable.
Yeah. Well, especially with like Severian, you're looking through his eyes, and you are kind of seeing his thoughts, you know, and you go, oh, well, I see myself there a little bit, you know, that's not great. You know? And maybe I shouldn't think that way, you know, about, you know, and so Severian's kind of like a mirror as well for people reading the story. Or it's like, oh, like what we were saying, I know that guy, I've met Severian, you know. But Severian's not like a really bad guy, you know. He's not like this evil dude. He's very broken and flawed, you know. So he's sympathetic, but you still don't like all of his actions. And it's not like you could say, well, I could see why he did that. It's like, no, I don't, like, he should not have done that or whatever it was, you know. But it's like you can see his upbringing and like just the world he inhabits. It's like, what else do you expect of him? You know, it's like he's trying his best with what little he's been given. And so I guess the last thing, since maybe we have are you good on time for a little bit longer, Mark?
I've got a few more minutes. Yeah, we can gloss over it. And, you know, we can always return at a later date.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Compelled to and talk again on specific stories.
Yes, that'd be awesome. So I just finished reading And When They Appear by Wolf. It's one of his Christmas stories. He's got a number of Christmas stories. And since it's almost Christmas and this story disturbed the heck out of me, I feel the need to talk about it. Like, my wife is sick of me talking about it with her. And so what, just give us the brief background of the story, and like, why is it considered one of Gene Wolfe's most depressing stories?
Yeah, sure. So in this, you have a near future society where the wealthy have been kind of ensconced in their elaborate houses that pretty much perform all the functions you could need. Like, the house will give you food, it will take care of you, it will provide entertainment, but not everybody's wealthy,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so there seems to be in the background a little bit of uprising. I think that the general's name is Carker, who is a kind of an army of rabble that has been burning these houses as they go. And
mm-hmm.
so the main character is a young boy named Sherby. And this is in line with a lot of the young protagonists of a lot of Wolfe's other fictions, like you know, the Island of Dr. Death and other stories, where there's a young character who seems to be innocent, and yet there's something more there. So in this, Sherby wakes up, it's near Christmas time, and the house has decided to teach him a lesson by using holograms, basically, of Christmas figures over time. So you've got, you know, Ebenezer Scrooge, but it also syncretizes all the pagan traditions.
Yeah.
So like all of the Yuletide things, they all come into this. Loki appears. They talk about the sun and how it's dim and how you're going to recapture the sun, you know. And so the winter solstice is also involved here as the darkest part of the year. And eventually that army is approaching. And we learn what has happened to Sherby's family. His father has pretty much poisoned the family and I think shot himself. I haven't read it in a while, mm-hmm. but basically committed suicide because he knows that their society, this the have and the have nots, that distinction is about to end and that their life is pretty much over. Mm-hmm. And so in this future, even though there's wealthy people, there's really not much hope. And so Sherby is kind of stuck in this house. It won't let him go anywhere. It won't let him do anything. But it's trying to entertain him with the meaning of Christmas there. Mm-hmm. And so Santa Claus appears, other apparitions. There's even Yeshua ben Joseph, I think, as he's called there, like Jesus, appears at a certain point to talk to him. And so it is very much like the spirits of Christmas appear. But the army breaks in. And while House tries to defend him with the means that he has, in the confusion and chaos, Sherby winds up in the captivity of kind of a depraved anti-Santa Claus there. I think it's Corporal Chris is his name.
Or something like that. Corporal Chris is the name he gave Sherby.
Corporal, yeah.
Corporal Clark, something like that.
Okay, Chris is the name he gave Sherby. Okay.
Because he's Corporal Clark's Christmas presents. He calls him Chris, right?
So it's, okay, that's yeah. right. Ugh. Yes, I had yeah. it. I apologize. I remembered something like Corporal. And I had kind of equated that with corporeal in my mind. Mm-hmm. And pretty mm-hmm. much at the end, he's left in the hands of a pedophile who has maybe just finished molesting him. Mm-hmm. But there's some brief hope because at the start of the story, like there's this little automated reconnaissance, like I think it's called Mouse, that goes out there. And at the end, Sherby's reaching under his pillow and he sees that it's there, you know, that it might actually help him escape. So there's like this little hope
yeah.
in the face of depravity. His
mouse but has also, a knife. It's a knife, like a yes. retractable knife that comes out. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But there's also a scene in there at the very end where they're coming into the house and Necht Rupert, I think, is there. And he's kind of like, he's going to beat you with switches and put you in a burlap bag if you've been bad during Christmas.
Right.
But he stands to defend Sherby. So sometimes the bad things can protect you. And House wants to get him down into the cold locker there, you know, where his parents' bodies are stored to save him. But Sherby rejects that. And so as a result of him trying to escape, he winds up in a far worse situation. Maybe. Who knows if he would have burned to death or not? I think in the Twitter mm-hmm. conversation, you mentioned that there's an Adam and Eve connotation to this as well. Like he's lost yeah. innocence and there's that the cherubim with the sword there that's kind of guarding yep. Eden. I don't know that that's a direct analogy or not, but I think it works as well because there is a loss of innocence there that's
well then
quite astonishing.
With it being he's on a mountain too, so
yeah.
traditionally paradise is on a mountain, and the house is a form of paradise, right? It gives him everything he wants, but it's kind of like a false paradise, right? Because
yeah,
it's not definitely. Really real, and he wants to leave. He wants to leave this paradise, which is understandable, right? Because he's kind of trapped there. The house means well. It's not. At first, I thought the house was going to be, you know, crazy robot house, you know, that's really trying to kill him. And no, the house is genuinely wanting his protection, almost to a fault, because there were caretakers there who had left, and the house would not let them take Sherby because the house was trying to protect him, but also dooming him at the same time. So it's kind of like, and I think in your write up, you the house was called Lonely Mountain. And it's a reference to The Hobbit, and you had made that connection. And Smaug, the house is kind of like almost like a benevolent Smaug, if that makes sense, where it's like, it gives, you know, but he's still trying to hoard Sherby to an extent, right? It still wants to protect Sherby, but he's not willing to let Sherby leave It is dangerous out there. There's a mob out there wanting to, you know, kill and burn and, you know, all that stuff. And so when he looks, when the house is trying to preserve his innocence in a way, and there was a deal struck with between him and the house while people are trying to break in. Sherby is allowed to look outside if he meets Santa Claus first, right? So Sherby wants to look outside. He wants to see what's going on out there. And I think that was his fall, right? Like he wanted to perceive the depravity. He wanted to see what was going on. And there was also a scene where he does go outside before the rioting really reaches their house. And he descends the mountain a little bit, but it's easy going down. But when he turns around to go back up, it's much harder to get back up the mountain, which also kind of leads into a paradise reading, that it's harder to ascend into paradise than it is to leave it, right? So I don't know. That was my kind of reading of it. It was like the Krampus figure with the big flaming sword was kind of the cherubim, you know, turning on Sherby, and the lights go out, and then he's captured by the anti-Santa. And the reading that after the story was done, Wolf had a little note that said something like Sherby like should not have rejected Santa Claus because he ended up with the anti-Santa, yeah, who is much, much worse. And the anti-Santa is kind of this amalgamation of like big masculine terror and like also effeminate sort of squeaky girl voice.
It's a fairy story too.
Yeah. 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 That was your reading of it as well, which, yeah. It's like a fairy story. Super dark. Very, very dark.
Yeah. So,
but yeah,
I think that, you know, another thing to realize about the story, though, is the way that Wolf syncretizes everything.
He's right.
Aware that Christmas is a tradition and that some of those traditions are not sweet, homogenous. You know, there's like a nastiness to some of those pagan traditions,
yep,
about death and destruction.
Yep.
And that sometimes that brings us to something greater. That renewal. So you experience something negative and then it leads to something better. And I think,
right,
that's another theme that might be playing out there. But this is about the most negative thing that I can think could happen.
So,
I mean, he even has to stone the gift of the donkey. He has,
right,
to like act against it and destroy it, which is something that would be, I mean, that would destroy me as a child.
Right.
I had to do something like that. And so he's experiencing something just unspeakably dreadful. I am going to have to go in a couple minutes here, but
okay.
I did want to talk about one more thing. You,
mm-hmm,
know, we've talked about Wolf. We haven't really talked about where to start with his work.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Book of the New Sun is his most famous, you know, but it's not necessarily easy to get into because you've got 5 volumes or 12 volumes. You're going to go through the whole solar cycle there, even though you can read just the first 4 that are usually combined in 2 omnibuses, Shadow and Claw, Sword and Citadel. If you like mainstream, you know, if somebody's like a fan of like Faulkner or mainstream novels, maybe Peace would be the best starting point for,
mm-hmm,
something like that. If you like colonialism in your science fiction and you're still interested in aliens and identity and things like that, there's The Fifth Head of Cerberus. But if you have time for short stories, I think his best short story collection is probably The Island of Dr. Death and Other Stories and Other Stories. Or The Best of Gene Wolfe is also great. It has so many great novellas, so many things that are worth looking at again and again. And finally, you know, if you just want a late novel, like urban fantasy, I think Sorcerer's House is a good place to start, too. It doesn't have the heavy prose that New Sun has. Like, there's maybe less enjoyment, but it's just fun to read. It's a fun,
yeah,
book, and there's still a lot to get to the heart of. You know, and if you hate first person, then I think that his best third person. I've really started to like Theodore's more. As I got a little older. I didn't like it, I think, the first time I read it, but now I started to appreciate what he was doing there. And, you know, if you don't care that your character isn't necessarily heroic in proportions, if you want an ordinary person, you know, kind of going through life and struggling and things like that, then I think Theodore's can be compelling if you view it that way.
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you, Mark. This has been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot just talking to you, so I'm kind of losing my voice here a little bit.
Okay.
But maybe that's a good time to stop. But I got one more question for you, and it's I don't know if you've ever listened to the show before, but every time a new guest comes on, I ask him this question. The show is called I Might Believe in Fairies because I am personally agnostic as to the existence of fairies. But I want to know, Mark Armini, do you believe in fairies?
I believe in something that can't be explained. Oftentimes I attribute it to the powers of the mind, you mm-hmm. know, like to know certain things that you shouldn't know, to see things in the world that are not necessarily there. So I think that there's something that's acting around us all the time. And if the ancients wanted to call them fairies, then that might be it. But I also think that there is an intelligence behind it that is not necessarily just ensconced in the individual perceiving it. So I'm going to say, yes, I do. And I don't put it on the level of God, for example, but I believe in something in the world that kind of creates and shapes and alters destiny sometimes, and that every once in a while you can peer in and perceive it. So I'm going to say yes, but perhaps not in the classical sense.
It's fair enough. Awesome. Well, thank you, Mark. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank you, Aaron. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you are excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.